So this is the licensing IP class. It is, as you know, you do not yet have a syllabus. That will continue through this evening. It is not going to be a problem in terms of work that you have to do that you don't have, mainly because I was planning on using one book. I realized in looking at it, it's dated to 2005. I am in the process of getting, hopefully, an electronic version of a much more recent book that focuses on the business use of IP and the transactional side that I think will be very much more relevant. I'm hoping because it's available in an ebook, it will be cheaper, which is always a good thing. But I will not be requiring reading until A, I specify the book, and B, I make sure it's here in paper form. So. But in any event, my suspicion is that the readings will simply frame the discussion. This is not a casebook course. And I like having references, but I'm going to apologize in advance for making you buy a book. Because much of what we're going to talk about is very practical. Hopefully the book we get will have that, but a lot of it is going to be framed in the reading. We're going to need to do the reading, but this is not an exam from the reading course. So what are we going to talk about here? This is, of course, a three-credit, which, because of the oddness of the evening schedule, is broken out into two 75-minute days per week, which is not ideal. Not ideal because we have some exercises and simulations through the rest later in the semester. It makes it a little bit difficult, but we'll persevere. So this fulfills the intermediate skills requirement. I know this comes as a shock to all of you who wouldn't have, that would never have come into any kind of consideration for choosing this course, but that's okay. And we're gonna, as much as I like to hear myself talk, we're gonna have a lot of discussion. Speaking of hearing, it is my practice, generally speaking, to audio record every class. Those recordings will, in the fullness of time, hopefully sooner rather than later, make their way onto a link through the TWEN page. The TWEN page is now active for the course. There will be a link along the left side that says audio recordings. It actually links out to another website because you can't store big files on TWEN. This is not an excuse for non-attendance. I doubt that many of you have seen the movie Back to School. Anyone? Rodney Dangerfield? Do you know the scene I'm thinking of? There's a scene somewhere in Back to School where it's a lecture hall and the teacher's talking to the students. And then the teacher's talking and some of the students have set up tape recorders. And then you see the tape recorder in the front talking to the tape recorders in the back. That's not the point. The point is that I don't want you to be transcribing. Because you will need to know, and there will be an exam at the end of the semester, which will be a practical exam, meaning that you're going to be given fact patterns, you're going to be given situations, and you're going to have to write answers. Whether it's write a letter to a client, or draft a license provision, or take this license provision and modify it, and I will likely do that as a take-home to give you time to do it well. But I don't want you to be staring at your computers. I don't want you to be transcribing, to feel the need to transcribe every word. I'm not going to say no computers in this class, largely because you will be using them. I do ask that those of you who do bring computers or tablets or other mobile devices, don't do anything on them that will distract people around you. Feel the need to zone out with boring stuff. So there will be audio recordings to the extent that I have PowerPoints. Those will also be posted. So really, your notes should be, with those things already in mind, the meaning. I want to have some good discussions. My practice has been primarily in and around licenses. In a broad sense. I've been a lawyer since 1992, practicing technology business law for almost that entire time. not an IP lawyer, but just about everything I worked with was intellectual property. You couldn't really hold it, whether it was software or websites, e-commerce platforms, privacy policies. It's all about intellectual property. And unless you are transferring ownership on your client or obtaining ownership, full control, the sharing part, sharing access, that's a license. And so much of my practice has been thinking about and working with clients on licenses that I'm really glad that we're able to not only create this course, but turn it into an intermediate skills course. Last time I taught this, and I'm hopeful we will be able to do this again, during the semester, the night that we had our negotiation session, we had real lawyers here, including a couple of alumni, one who had taken the course before it became intermediate skills, as lawyers for the other side. And it was real. It wasn't actual. But the quality of the negotiation, the points being raised, I think the students then surprised themselves. And I think you will find yourself very much in that position of being able to do that, and hopefully with practitioners, whether it's the same or others, later in the semester. There is one other fun possibility, and I'm not going to promise because the details are still being worked out. This semester, anyone here a Stony Brook alum? Okay, not currently there as a joint degree, just. So this semester, the Stony Brook College of Business, their graduate division, is for the first time offering an IP course, sort of a business of IP course, being taught by, I think, the lawyer on the faculty. It's an evening course. My hope, and I've been speaking with him, it's the first time he's teaching it, so he's still working out the curriculum. My hope is that we're going to get his students together with you guys. Because just as you are playing the role and learning the role of client, of lawyers, they're learning the role of clients. And so whether we do it remotely or otherwise, if it all works out, we may have some interactions with that other class. I think that will really add to the value and add to the diversity of the discussion. But what are we going to get to? We're going to understand licenses. We're going to understand what they are, why they are, and how to do them. And when you need writings and what kind of writings. We're going to look at the different kinds of intellectual property. Excuse me. I think all of you have had some sort of IP-related class as a prerequisite, yes? No, you're shaking your head. You haven't taken anything of the sort? No technology, patent, license?
I think it's a semester.
Okay, or as a co-requisite. Okay, good. Because there's a vocabulary. But I'm not going to assume that all of you have had the basic IP course. I didn't require that for a reason, because there are a lot of different paths. So during our discussion, we will give a full vocabulary, the basic vocabulary of the different types of intellectual property. Copyrights, trademarks, patents. Those are the big three. Trade secrets. Some of the related things like privacy and big data. Data, customer records, behavioral records, those are all intellectual property too, and they may be licensed. And so we'll talk about the similarities and the unique differences across intellectual property. We will look also at the other laws and legal regimes that impact on licenses and in turn are impacted by licenses. A little preview. If you've thought at all about intellectual property or learned about it, you know that it is the intellectual property rights that you get, that one gets, are a legal monopoly. There are a lot of illegal monopolies, especially in the United States. Patents, copyrights, trademarks, they are legal monopolies, but they're limited. And the limiting of monopolies falls under the category of antitrust law. We'll talk some, generally speaking, about antitrust law and the idea of a monopoly and how it plays out in the context of intellectual property and of licenses. The idea of exclusive rights is both a positive and a negative in different contexts. We will look at bankruptcy law. Bankruptcy law in particular, when we get to it. Because it turns out that bankruptcy law has, well, it is its own thing. And if any of you have taken creditors' rights or have hopefully not personally dealt with bankruptcies, you know, bankruptcy law trumps almost everything else. When you have a federal judge in the United States hearing or controlling a bankruptcy case, having accepted a bankruptcy petition, that judge can basically do a lot of things that would otherwise not be possible in contracts and business relations and the like. Turns out there is a unique carve-out for IP, and we will get to why that is and what it is and how you, as lawyers, are going to have to deal with it as you think about it. And there will be others. We'll look a little at some of the international law issues that impact on licenses. We will spend time understanding drafting. We will understand what? We will understand both the general principles of drafting, of what you need to think about in writing any kind of contract, and then specifically licenses. What kind of terms go into them? Where do you find those words from? Which words make differences? What are the magic phrases? What things are acceptable to put into a license agreement and what things aren't? And the mechanics of drafting. We'll look at review and revision. Not only look at, we're going to do these things. When your client presents you with, here's a license agreement, now what? We'll talk about what that is, how you read it, how you in turn explain it to your client, and what you do to revise it, the mechanics and the strategy of revision. We'll do some negotiation. We'll do some simulated negotiation amongst ourselves. We'll do it with, hopefully, outside lawyers. If we go by the last time I taught this class, those sessions will be video recorded. And I will review them, and then we will review them so that we can together see what worked, what didn't, how the lawyers, who some of them have a bit of a, I don't want to say a nasty streak because that's the wrong way to put it, but they're a little tricky, and they throw some curves purposely because they understand the context of this, and they want to teach you, even if they come in as guests. But we'll talk about the philosophy of negotiation, my philosophy. You're going to come up with your own. But as I do with my externs, I will share with you where my perspective as a practicing lawyer came from and why I think it is one good approach. And then we'll deal with how you negotiate, when to give, when not to give, why, etc. And we will spend some time over the semester. These are not unique units per se. This is all going to intersect. We're going to spend some time talking about clients and how to communicate to them and keep them as part of the process. It's tough. One of your roles as a lawyer is as a translator. To explain to a client in a way that is accurate, but doesn't overwhelm the client with things that the client just can't understand or doesn't have the background to understand, but also listening to the client and knowing which questions to ask the client to get information the client didn't realize you needed. One of the reasons I want to involve the business school is because to do this right, really to do any business law right, you have to understand business. Now, how many of you are night students? Good. How many of you are not night students? How many of you are 3 a.m. students? No, it's fine. I only say good because I like having the perspective. So you night students, you have day jobs. What do you all do? Just if you'd share who you are, because I'm really bad with names, and you know, tell everybody else who may not have met you.
Casey Hilbert, I'm the president of New York Lizards and Major League Lacrosse team.
Where does it? Where do the Lizards play?
Right now we play at Hofstra.
Very cool.
Adam DeRosa, I'm a patent agent at Scully Scott European Presser, and also an affiliate in the Stony Brook University Technology Licensing Office.
Now there's a nice person to have in this class. A little imposing, I have to say. Do you all know what a patent agent is? Anybody not?
It's
so we can switch places if you want, Adam.
No, that's right.
Anybody not know? It's okay. It really is what a patent agent is. We sort of have semi-shrugged. So patent agents are people who've taken a bar exam before going to law school, or whether or not they go to law school. Patent agents are people who have successfully completed the exam with the Patent and Trademark Office that lets them assist on patents, that they are qualified and certified to practice before the Patent and Trademark Office. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, you're licensed to practice before the United States Patent and Trademark Office.
But you're not licensed to practice law.
No, you can't try a case before the Federal Circuit. You can't try an intellectual property-based case in federal court. But you can file patents for clients, for et cetera, before the Patent Office.
It's an interesting thing. So you have patent lawyers who are basically both. And you have patent agents. No? I'm saying patent lawyers generally also could be taken not only the regular bar exam, but the patent bar exam. But patent agents are qualified to practice before the Patent and Trademark Office, but not qualified to practice law in the state of New York or anywhere else. It's an interesting thing. And I also look forward to hearing perhaps what we will be talking about academic licensing and technology transfer. And having that insight, not confidential information, please, of course, but will be really helpful, so thank you. Were our other, raise their hands?
Bill Valley, I'm an engineer for Brookhaven National Laboratory, Lexors 2. Next week I actually start as a law clerk at Carter DeLuca College.
Excellent. So we have a Scully Scott and a Carter DeLuca. And hopefully you've heard about the event that we are doing with Carter DeLuca on March 7th. If you haven't, and this may be of interest to all of you, on, I think it's Friday morning, March 7th, here at the Law Center, we, along with Carter DeLuca and the Export Division of the U.S. Department of Commerce, will be doing our second annual event. This one will be on big data. And so hopefully you'll all be able to attend. Those of you who are here, fine, during the day. Those of you who aren't, take off from work or make it a business trip, whatever it is. More details to follow, but you may get involved. So, excellent. You're working a lot at Carter DeLuca. Great. Other hands being raised? Yes?
My name is Joan J. Brady, and I work at a personal injury medical malpractice law firm.
As what? You're a para. I will say, Joan, that says a lot for the lawyers with whom you work. Because as someone who's been in some of the big law firms, the way that some of those big law firms treat paralegals, I can't imagine a paralegal ever wanting to be one of those people. So the fact that you're here says good things about your colleagues. So welcome. Other hands? Mary, you're a night student? Another person who says good things about your colleagues. Were there others? Okay. It's a good mix. And you day students, you bring your own. Don't please. This is not a second class citizen, I promise. But I teach in stories some of which you'll hear more than once. And I think that we'll be able to really draw a lot of experience from all of you. And so I appreciate that. So, and then of course, overall, we're going to talk about practice skills. So there will be readings. There will be a syllabus, I promise. Like I say, I want to make this the most effective and cost-effective set of readings I can. And I apologize for the delay, but I think that will hopefully work out. I expect all of you to participate. It's a small class. We are a seminar. So hopefully I won't have to call names in order to invoke some response. As I said, there's a TWEN page. Please sign up for it as soon as you can, because I will be using its email function to email to you about stuff, whether it's additional readings or new developments. In fact, I was approached by another law student who's not taking this course this evening in the cafeteria to talk about the Aereo case. Anybody know about Aereo, A-E-R-I-O? Has anyone followed this? So it's a licensing case that's now going up before the U.S. Supreme Court. Aereo is an online business that streams television. It competes with the cable television companies. It has a really interesting model. Basically, Aereo stuck up an antenna and picks up whatever broadcast signals are available and lets people essentially rent that antenna from them. And the cable companies are a little up in arms, and the broadcasters are a little bit up in arms. But Aereo's view is, it's out there. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than that, but the idea is every one of these people is entitled to put up his or her own antenna and receive these signals. And all we're doing is basically giving them a shared antenna, the same way you would have a shared antenna in, say, an apartment building before we had cable television. It's just a really long wire. And they're paying for the privilege of sharing our antenna. And that case will raise some really interesting licensing questions. And as it progresses, and there are other cases and situations that progress, I will be sharing them through email. And if, to the extent that anything comes up, I would be grateful if you would share it with me for me to share with the class. But definitely sign up for the TWEN page. There will be readings, et cetera. The exercises. I will be assigning written exercises throughout the semester. We will be doing simulations. All of that, together with the final, will constitute your grade. It's not quite a formal midterm, but your participation in those exercises and the work that you put in will contribute towards that grade. I won't be grading them necessarily, formally grading each one, in part because you're going to be in teams for a lot of these, and it's going to be collaborative. But I will be recording and looking at your participation to inform the ultimate grade on the class. And as I told you, and we'll discuss further, there will be a final exam that will likely be a take-home exam. Okay, questions so far? Oh, I think we're okay. I know that in the past I have taught evening classes that have crossed over from the cafeterias open to the cafeterias not open period. I don't think that any of you will not have a chance to hit the cafeteria before class, right? Okay. Because for longer classes it becomes an issue, but I think for this one we're okay. Yes, sir.
Back to the patent agent.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what you need to take, like a science degree?
No, but
bar?
I can't. But what are in-house patent agent help out? I mean, I can't. But.
So you need, you have to have, I believe it's 60 credits or better in a science, in one of the hard sciences. So
or engineering, right. Right. Our Professor Aker's patent practice class really focuses on practicing before.
So that's it.
No, that I can't answer. If to the extent that you were like I was and you, you know, got something useless in, as an undergraduate degree, people do take postgraduate courses. They just need to have the credit hours. Yes, you do need a college degree, but it doesn't necessarily have to have been in the applied sciences. You need the BA or the BS, and you need to have those credits, but they don't have to have happened at the same time. Okay. What's a license? Anybody have a dog? You have a dog. Is your dog licensed?
No.
You have an unlicensed dog?
It's licensed.
Don't you have to get a pet license? Has that gone away? The tag on the collar? Do you not have to get a license for your dog anymore?
I think so.
Really?
No.
Your dog is licensed. Okay, his is walking around without a license. There's a Monty Python skit about the cat detector van and Eric the half a bee, but we're not going to get on with it. So your pet is licensed.
Yep.
So what, the dog owner granted you the rights to use the dog? Is that the license?
No, I think the dog terms is just identification.
So you wrote it down?
It's got a tag.
Did somebody give you the tag?
Yes.
Who?
The shelter I adopted. So New York State.
Oh wait, so the state licensed the dog for you, to you.
I think so. I had to pay a fee.
Right. So, does that fit into this discussion?
No.
Okay. So, one definition, a working definition of a license is the grant of rights to use by a property owner. Okay. But we have a dog license.
We're just giving a more like our license, our actual license that we keep in our wallet that gives us an identification number
right.
to be identified.
Is this a license? No. It's not. It's not. It's an indication of a license. If you leave it at home, are you a licensed driver? Sure you are. You're a licensed driver without your nice little hologram insignia. So the dog license is a license to, I guess you're permitted to legally have a dog, and yours is clearly a felon. I'm just picturing it sneaking under the window. Right? So, this is what? How does this indication, you know, we don't put these on our collars. How does that thing that's called a license that the state issued him in order to be permitted to own a dog connect with this piece of plastic issued by the state? What does this piece of plastic indicate?
That you have the right to drive an automobile in New York State.
Mm-hmm. I have permission to drive an automobile. It's true. When you get out of here successfully and you take that big exam thing, and you pass it, which you all will. And then, are you a lawyer? After you survive the Javits Center, and you wait for that email from the New York State Board of Bar Examiners, when that email comes, are you a lawyer? Not, are you? Better not say you are, because you'll have a problem becoming one. You are eligible to practice law. What do you need in order to practice law? All right, so right, there's a process, okay, and then you stand up in front of a court somewhere in some department or some other state, and you swear or affirm whatever it is you do, and you're admitted. It's a wonderful term, isn't it? Admitted. But in fact, it's not just an admission, is it? You're granted something, too. What are you granted when you are admitted?
License.
A license to practice law, which we also don't wear around our necks. We don't even have bar cards. I remember watching, I guess it was The Practice years ago, and every time one of the fake lawyers, you know, the actors playing lawyers would do something, the actor playing the judge would say, "I'm gonna take your bar card." We don't have bar cards, but we are admitted. We get a license to practice law. And if you don't have one, it's unlicensed practice, which is a bad thing. Okay. License to own a dog. License to practice law. License to drive a car. Those licenses are all issued by the state. Okay. Remember record stores? Or music stores? I guess they still sort of exist. Or video stores. What do you buy? When you go to a record store, or for that matter, you go to iTunes, what do you own? Yeah, that's correct. And that's true. Well, that's not all of what you own. If you get your music electronically, that's pretty much all of what you own. You own a license. What do you own if you buy a CD or a DVD? You own a piece of shiny round plastic, and you own a cardboard box or plastic jewel case. Those you own. Those are yours. Make them into coasters, whatever. They're yours. But the stuff on it, you don't own. You have a license, different kind of license. So what's the common thread? Because it really isn't necessarily a property owner, right? That's one kind. Intellectual property owner, and yes, that's why we're here, licensing intellectual property. What's the common thread across the car, the dog, the fish, whatever, the lawyer, and the movie and the song?
A license is intangible. You can't hold the license, you can only own.
Well, there are a lot of things that are intangible. But what's the common thread here? Perhaps. But what is it revoking? And don't say the license, because that's a circular thing.
Permission.
Permission. Thank you. Permission. You're Jake?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to pass around a thing at some point, but I figured you all could figure out where you want to sit and shuffle around at least once. Permission. What about that guy played by all those actors? His license number is 007. What is his license?
To kill.
License to kill. That's exactly right. Also to do a lot of other things, apparently. License. Permission. That's what a license is. It's a grant of permission. The state grants you permission to own a dog, to drive a car in the borders of the state on a regular basis. Do you need a license from the state? There's your trick question. Do you need a license from the state of New York to drive a car in the state of New York?
No.
No. Don't. Apparently the people who hit my car last week didn't have a license from any state, but that's another story. But what? But when do you need a license from the state of New York? At a certain point, when you're here for a certain amount of time and you wish to operate a vehicle on a regular basis, the state of New York says you must have a license from us. Or if you're operating certain kinds of commercial vehicles in the state of New York, school buses, trucks, whatever the state of New York may say, you need a license from us. But you don't. It's not a general grant of permission. They don't check you at the borders and, you know, give you driver's tests. Why does the state of New York care? Why is it in the business of granting licenses for dogs and lawyers and drivers? Why does it care? What's the cynical answer?
Money.
Right. But let's set aside cynicism at least for a little while. Why? Why does the state care? Did I see your hand? Was it just the money? Oh, okay. Any non-cynics in the room? Why does the state care? Okay, I can see that for dogs, and so what is, well, no. You filled out paperwork, but what did the pound do? What did the shelter do? What was the shelter's, they didn't make sure the dog was immunized?
They did, yes.
That, right? Anybody, have you done gone through this?
No.
Oh.
I
don't think that's, well, that may be a shelter policy. I don't think that's a state law.
Yeah.
But making sure that the dog doesn't have any dangerous diseases and, you know, being vaccinated against rabies and the like is probably a prerequisite to being licensed as a dog. So he's got a dangerous one. Why does the state care about drivers? Yeah, all right. Okay. Okay. Although we've said you don't need a license to drive in the state of New York, you just need a license to drive in the state of New York after a certain amount of time when you're going to be here regularly. So they don't track all the drivers through licenses. For that, they use other kinds of scary surveillance technology. Yeah. How so? Okay, let's separate. You're right, and I'm glad you raised this, because all of these types of licenses may have certain limits. Now, some of those limits are policy driven. Why does a driver's license have an expiration date? Because it does. Or a passport. Why do they have expiration dates? Passports, of course, are licenses to travel. Their licenses to leave and be readmitted into a country. Visa is the same way. It's a license to enter a country. Why do those licenses have expiration dates?
Because at a later point in time, they don't qualify for the license.
And so by making it expire, the idea is those people who care about being legal will go through the process of relicense, which gives the licensing authority the opportunity to check up. Now, it's not an everyday monitoring, but it's an along-the-way monitoring in some circumstances. So drivers are, you know, whatever it is, every 5 years, every 10. Passports the same way. For kids, it's 5. Why are kids have 5-year passports and adults have 10? Looks change. My kids, when they got their passports and they were this, you know, the photo is supposed to be functional. It doesn't really help much if they look nothing like it. Did your dog's license expire?
I believe so.
When?
I think annually.
So you've got to renew a dog's license?
I believe so.
Okay. Your license to practice law must be renewed every, I think it's 3 years. So there's that opportunity for rechecks. And with things like driving, there have been various proposals to, well, you have it on both ends. For new drivers, particularly teenage new drivers, they don't get full licenses, they get shorter term licenses with more restrictions, and then they have to progress in order to graduate to a full license. There are proposals on the older side of things to require certain rechecks for drivers whose reaction times, whose vision, basically the entire state of Florida, you know, it's when they aren't necessarily as capable as they had been. So there's that process. So sometimes a license, the permission grant, is made temporary for policy reasons. It's not true so much with IP, though. The license, as we'll see as we get into it, the permission grant in IP is also, generally speaking, temporary. But it's not, the reason it's temporary, I mean, let me put it this way. An IP license can be short term, but it doesn't have to be short term. The license terms may say perpetual, irrevocable. There is no law that says that an IP license must be revocable. It's not true. But patent licenses are not irrevocable, and they're not perpetual. They can't be. For that matter, neither can copyright licenses be perpetual, even if they say so. Why? Anyone know? It's true. Trademark too. Why not?
Because we want society to benefit from the invention if it's patentable. So we want them to use the invention too. We don't want to grant a monopoly on something that could be beneficial.
Step back for a minute though. You're not talking about the license. You are looking at the correct reason, but that's not the answer to the question. It's not that society puts a limit on the license, because it doesn't. What does society put the limit on?
I was going to say something.
Okay, well, what does society put the limit on?
For patents, the life of a patent.
Not just patents.
For copyright, the life of copyright.
Remember I said, and we'll get into it, that these are monopolies. We don't like monopolies. They tend to be, again, you may have economic discussions about this, but the mainstream view monopolies can be anti-consumer, and as a result, when they are permitted under U.S. law, and for that matter other laws, generally speaking, they are not permanent. They are limited-term monopolies, after which whatever the intellectual property is goes into the public domain. It is no longer owned by anyone. It is owned by everyone. And so whatever else is in that agreement, whatever the terms that are negotiated between the parties and the payments and the whatever else, there is always an outer limit, an end to that license. And the end to the license is, if nothing else matters, when the licensor, the party that owns the intellectual property, no longer has any exclusivity left. You have no permission to withhold. That's right. The only way you have permission to grant is if you have permission to withhold. But if you can't say no, if you may no longer say no, because the law says it's not yours to withhold anymore, the license is useless. I hereby give you permission that I can't give or keep withhold to use this thing. So a perpetual license, and you'll see this, particularly in copyright, because perpetual simply means for the next little while, you know, for the foreseeable future. But a perpetual license ends when the copyright protection ends. If there's a renewal period, great. But if not, done. That contract is over. It can no longer be enforced. And so that's not society putting a limit on the license. That's society putting a limit on the underlying rights that are shared with the license. Right? Make sense? We had hands. Were there questions or just answers? So we have now a working definition. A license is a grant of permission from a party that has the right to grant that permission or withhold it. How does a state have the right to withhold permission to drive? What, it's gonna, you know, your keys will vanish, your car will... How does the state withhold permission to drive? Okay, so what? Sure you will. The people that hit my car last week, all three of them were on the road.
You could be on the road, but you'd be doing so illegally.
So?
Statutory usually go through some sort of legislation with the state or some sort of municipality is given a right or a power to exercise such a right.
That said very much, but didn't really say much at all. How does a state... What does a state do to effectively withhold a license to drive? They could fine you, sure. They can imprison you. The state has police power. They have state police, for that matter. They have police power, and with that police power comes the right to enforce the rule about licensing. You have an unlicensed dog. The dog catcher, right? Remember, you've heard the dog catcher. Some old movie with guy with the net, right? What's the dog catcher doing? He's catching unlicensed dog. You've seen the beginning of Annie. Come on, right? Guy comes up, the dog catcher, and poor little Annie has to get the dog to come to him, you know. And he knows his name, and she saves him from the dog catcher somehow. The dog catcher is the state police officer charged with enforcing pet licensing requirements. Because otherwise, who'd bother? Public-spirited citizens will pay extra money to the state for the privilege of having a licensed canine. No. You want to have a dog that will not be impounded, literally impounded, and you want to have a car that if you get caught driving it will not get towed away from you, which is what happened to those people when they hit me. Their car was fine, but it still got towed away because there was no one who had permission on the scene to drive it. I had absolutely no sympathy for those people. So, those permission grants, and so, you know, lawyers, they're not going to necessarily, you know, they might fine you. I don't know if practicing law without a license is a jailable offense. Is it? I'm not quite sure ultimately what the penalty, you know, yes, they can fine you. But if it's worth your while to fake, you know, if you have the money to fake being, I'm not recommending this to any of you. You're spending enough money to really be lawyers. But, I mean, you think about it, right? They say, this came up, of course, and we have, it may not have been for the lizards, but with the discussion of the Islanders. Said, oh, well, the Islanders have to stay in the Nassau Coliseum through 2050. No, they didn't. They didn't. There was not going to be, you know, Nassau County Police Department locking them in the building. What would have happened had the Islanders owners decided to move them to Brooklyn a year early?
That would have been fined or sued.
Well, not necessarily fined. There would have been a penalty, a contract penalty. Contracts are only as, right? The contract is only as strong of a binding as the penalty is painful. Early termination. T-Mobile's doing this right now. We want you so much to get out of your... We know that the cell phone companies are going to penalize you by charging you early termination fees. We'll pay you off. We'll pay them off. So you may have financial penalties, and they may or may not be burdensome. You may have forfeiture, seizing penalties. So the state, I mean, you hear this all the time, that they seize cars and trucks, and then they actually auction them in the central islip. If you look at the back of the newspaper, I don't know if anybody's seen this. If you get the New York Times on Sunday, the back page of the business section, list all the auctions, and every week, there are vehicle auctions right here somewhere in central Islip. One of these days I'm going to go. But where do those vehicles come from? They're seized in the police power, sometimes, you know, not usually through the non-licensed drivers, but ultimately criminals. So they have police power to enforce. How do licensors of intellectual property force you to take a license? The state forces you to get a driving license by having people in cars with lights on top, but if they happen to find you, you will have a bad day. You might have 10 to 20 bad days, right? So, and if they find your patent, and how do people who own the rights to intellectual property force you to license as opposed to simply you? Infringement means you're not you are utilizing the intellectual property other than through with permission, right? With a license. And sometimes that's because you had a license and you went beyond it. Sometimes it's because you never had a license, and sometimes, particularly the patent side, is because you've never heard of that other intellectual property, but it turns out what you're doing and what it is are too similar. And so you're infringing, and you need to get a license. So how do IP holders enforce their power to license? How do they go after infringers?
Litigation.
So what gives them the rights? I mean, litigation means so they file a lawsuit. That's good. And what's the claim? Okay, and on what basis can one get, there's a law, right? There's a statute not only that grants the monopoly, there's a statute that grants the rights to enforce that monopoly, and you may have statutory damages, or you may have the damages regime provided for by statute, actual damages, statutory damages, treble damages, which has nothing to do with music. So the law, the same legal system that grants the monopoly, grants the ownership rights, and we're going to get into, as we get into the later in the semester, exactly what that means, grants the rights to provide or withhold licenses. Sometimes it mandates. There are certain situations where the law compels a license to happen. And it also provides for remedies. And it's not just provides for remedies. What else does the law do?
Injunction.
Well, yeah. There may be injunctive relief. But the law has to have some teeth, doesn't it? You win a lawsuit for damages. The other party says, nah, I'm not going to pay them. Then what? What else does the law provide? Generally, it's not just in the IP. What does the law provide? Which you're also not going to pay. What does the law provide?
How to seize access.
The law provides a mechanism for obtaining the value of that judgment. seizure of property, garnishment of wages, all those wonderful words. Ultimately, some legal system, in order to make a license that matters, that is enforceable, that is revocable, that legal system has to provide for the right to grant the license, that whatever the underlying rights are in our legal system, under our Constitution, states are given the control over their own roads. We could just as easily have a national driving license. We don't. Some countries do, we don't. Our system gives that right to control who may use the roads to the states. And the states set those standards. And the states also have local police power that allows them to make those licensing standards matter and stick. IP rights, there are state IP rights. I don't want to suggest there aren't. We do have, not patents, but we do have state copyrights, I think, and we certainly have state trademarks. But people don't generally pursue them because we're a national and international market. That exclusivity doesn't have a lot of value. So we have a national regime of IP protection, of granting those monopolies, granting those rights. And then that same set of laws provides for a mechanism for licensing and provides for a mechanism for enforcing those licenses or infringing of those rights and collecting on those. Without all of those pieces, it's useless. It doesn't matter. And we see a perfect demonstration of this outside of the IP and outside of the licensing context. Something called use taxes. Anyone familiar with a use tax? You wouldn't be, because until fairly recently, nobody cared. Do you know what a sales tax is? What's a sales tax? Oh, come on. Sometimes you actually get easy questions in law school. What's a sales tax? Nobody knows what a sales tax is. I despair. I know. What's a sales tax?
Tax on whatever you purchase.
Okay. What does that mean, a tax?
The government or the state will get money based on your purchases.
Right. Certain items are not taxed, but certain items, in addition to paying the actual price for the item to the retailer, the purchaser must pay more money that the retailer then sends up to the taxing authority, the state. And there are various justifications for it, various products, various levels. Sales tax. What if you buy something from another state? Now, until fairly recently, it was true for most online purchases, and before that for mail order purchases. The taxing authority doesn't extend past the borders of a state. Or rather, a state must have, and there's a Supreme Court case, the Quill case, which wasn't about actual pens, but was the Quill office supply company. And ultimately, in sales tax, this concept came up of a nexus. Not the Lexus Nexus, but that in order for a state to charge tax on a purchase and collect that tax on a purchase as a sales tax, the state must have some, or rather the seller must have some presence, some nexus, connection to that state. So if, for example, and this is, you started seeing this in the offline world, L.L. Bean, famously in what state? he knows from L.L. Bean. L.L. Bean is a very well known among, I guess, older people. They sell camping goods and duck boots and sweaters and knapsacks and things, and they're in Maine, Freeport, Maine, very famously. Or Ben and Jerry's ice cream, right? Ben and Jerry's is in Vermont. L.L. Bean is in Maine. For the longest time, L.L. Bean was only located in Maine. It had its factories there, it had a big store there, and if you were in Maine and you went to L.L. Bean, you paid sales tax if it was a taxable item. And if you were in Maine and L.L. Bean mailed you your order, you paid sales tax. And if you were anywhere else, L.L. Bean didn't have stores, it didn't have factories, it didn't have full-time employees or offices. Nobody else charged sales tax on L.L. Bean purchases. And then L.L. Bean opened up, I think, an outlet store in Colonia outside of Albany, New York. And suddenly, people from New York who were mail ordering L.L. Bean were being charged New York sales tax. Okay, so that's sort of the sales tax. And you may have noticed that Amazon.com, even though it's based in Washington somewhere, I think it's in Washington, charges sales tax in New York, and there's a whole big lawsuit about that. We can talk about it in another context. But when a state doesn't have that nexus, there really is a point here. When a state doesn't have that nexus, it still has the right to charge tax. It's called a use tax. And every state has a use tax statute, just about every state. New York has had a use tax statute forever. And the whole idea of a use tax is, well, yeah, there's no nexus. But in order to get to you, those goods still had to travel our roads and use our postal system, you know, our worker protection for the people who are in the state, and all the reasons why states have justification for charging you. And the state said, if you buy something from mail order and you haven't paid sales tax, or for that matter, if you buy something locally, you buy a car from somebody, and you weren't charged sales tax, you have to pay use tax. We'll get you coming or going. And you know who paid use tax? Nobody. You know why? There were no penalties. There was no enforcement. The law was on the books. Maybe there was, you know, the public-spirited citizens sent the checks. Nobody paid use tax. And then you know what the state of New York did? Very, very smart. The state of New York put a little new line on the tax form. And if you do New York tax forms, income tax, you'll see this line. It lasts maybe 4 or 5 years. There's a line in your IT-201, whatever it is. Have you bought anything mail order that you haven't paid sales tax on? Yes or no? If you say yes, you have a choice. You can come up with the actual value and pay the use tax, or pay a calculated value based on your income. So what did that do? What it did, the use tax still itself has no penalty, and more to the point, has no way of enforcing it. But what happens now if you bought something and didn't pay the use tax? Yep, exactly right. What is that? Al Capone, right? They got him on tax evasion. Now, if you don't pay your use tax because you've lied on your form, and they find out, they've got you for tax evasion. Not just use tax evasion, but lying on your income tax form. That's a bad thing. So what the state did there was it created an enforcement mechanism. It's pretty clever, actually. Annoying, but pretty clever. Here, too. If you have an intellectual property regime, in theory, but you have no enforcement mechanism, it's the tree falling in the woods. And that's not a hypothetical situation. It's not. Because there are lots of contexts where there are intellectual property laws, but no enforcement or no effective enforcement. Teenagers are not all being sued for infringement. Or, and I'm sure none of you has illegally downloaded, not paid for music anymore. And never would have, but you people, right? They once, I tell this story every time I talk about this stuff. I was watching a debate for the Attorney General primary some years ago. One of the questions were that they asked all, it was the sort of the drug question, but in this case it was, have you ever illegally downloaded music? Oh, I wouldn't know how to do that. When you're running, you're not going to get away with that answer any more than the I didn't inhale answer. That doesn't, you know, we're past that. But there is a, you know, the music companies freaked out about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, because suddenly there was this entire mechanism for making perfect copies at a distance that didn't require anybody to pay anything, and there was no effective way of stopping people. So what did they do? They did two things. One is they used whatever legal rights they had, and so they went after the record labels, the publishers, music publishers. They went after the technology companies that particularly made this possible: Napster, Grokster, Kazaa. They did something else though. They made it easier, cheaper, and more efficient to get a legal license. iTunes, Amazon Music. Before you could buy a song, well, no, it's not true. You could always, as long as there have been records, you could buy a song. They used to be called singles. And they were small little records and they spun faster than the big records did, and you had to put a little thing in. But you could only buy the songs that were released as singles, and if you wanted any others, you had to buy the album. And then singles sort of went away, but people still wanted to just buy a song. And there was no way to do it, and so they would go and illegally download the song. And then they figured out, they being the Apples and the Amazons and the other people in the world, figured out that, you know what? If we make it possible to buy a license for a song, and just one, and we make it cheap, people are actually going to do it. And so now, people are still illegally downloading music. A lot of people aren't. Even a lot of teenagers aren't. It's because all it costs is a buck. The law was not the best method for preserving the rights under those licenses. Preserving the rights, right? It wasn't the most effective means. What was most effective was making it easier for more people to take legal licenses. And that tension exists everywhere in this whole context. The only way to force a license on someone is to enforce the rights. Either you get take a license from me, or as long as I've got the monopoly, I will use the law to punish you, and I have the power under the law. If I don't have the power under the law, I can yell and scream and say lots of nasty things about you, but that's it. Ask software publishers about China. The nation of China. On paper, China has the same intellectual property protection that many other modern nations do. China has copyright protection and patent protection and trademark protection, etc. But enforcement is almost non-existent. So it's meaningless. Movie companies in the United States have lots of trade, but you walk down Delancey Street and you're going to find guys on the street selling you a DVD of the movie that's in the theater down the street. And, you know, and unless they can be caught and prosecuted, you're not going to be able to force them or their producers to license. So as we go through the semester, and in our next class, we'll go into this, I think, a little bit more in terms of the process, generally speaking, of what is a license functionally. But I wanted to really, it's worth thinking about the theory, because it informs all of these licenses. That idea of somebody has a right established by a law. And that right is to share or to exclude, and it is empowered by some sort of effective enforcement, or it's meaningless, and it is delimited by either the types of things that may be granted that right, or how long that right may be granted, or to whom it may be granted. The law provides for the mechanism, but will also provide the limits on that mechanism. And within that box is where this class and what we talk about exists. Have a good night, safe home, all that good stuff.